Accession number 9168.
Reel 15.
Mr. Amat, reel 15.
As I was a senior NCO, I had to take charge of the section, and each section took it in turns to escort these lorries through the Khyber Pass up into Kabul, the capital of Afghanistan. But as we had to meet these lorries at 6 o'clock in the morning outside Jamrud Fort, it meant that I had to get the men up by soon after four. And it was quite a job, because after someone had been drinking in the canteen the night before, I had to literally kick them into activity to get them down to the armour car garage to start the engines and move the escort back to the appointed rendezvous. Anyway, we had quite a job starting the engine, because at this time there was frost on the ground, and although it was India, it gets exceptionally cold, and everybody was wearing normal serge uniform, not the drill summer uniform we normally wore. And eventually I got the cars down there and met the convoy, and there was always an officer in charge of the whole lot, and we had a lieutenant there who Lieutenant Crouch, his name was, and he was an ex middleweight champion boxer in the army class in the army. And anyway, we took several of these convoys through during the time I was there. And one day he used to use a T-shaped Ford, the old T-shaped Ford, and he used to accompany the convoy through. By the way, at this stage, I'd like to describe the fact that this road from Jamrud Fort through to the frontier of Landikotal and Landikana was a winding road that more or less kept on the same contour just above a river or a stream. But the thing about the Khyber Pass was that every few miles there was a post manned by Indian soldiers, and these posts were built like lighthouses. They were tall, about 25 or 30 feet, and usually built of stone, tapering up to a platform at the top, and they were all quite about 20 or 30 feet in diameter, so quite a big structure. But anyway, as the area we were going through was amongst the warring Waziers and the tribes that lived in that area, it was quite dangerous for troops marching on foot to traverse these roads. So what they'd done was they'd made an aerial railway, similar to the ones you see in Switzerland and other countries that are very mountainous. And this cable railway used to run from one side of a valley to the other on large pylons, and cable cars were just a couple of forgot the name of the thing. Anyway, there's sort of a carriage suspended from the rope, the wire rope, with a box like a ferret at the bottom, and in there was put all the supplies, the ammunition, what have you. And this was electrically propelled along this wire cable right the way along, and fed at each one of these posts along these strategic points in the frontier. And another thing about is the fact that as we drove up through the pass, the villages on either side were built of mutty and thatched roofs and very primitive, But all these tribes were also very primitive, but they were nearly always fighting each other, especially after the harvest had been caught in, been brought in. There was nothing for the men to do, so they used to engage in a battle of tribal warfare. And as we went by, I remember the one tribe would be firing the other across the road we were traversing. So we used to have to close our all our armoured doors and hope that nobody, no stray bullets came across. Anyway, we got to the Afghan border, but the Afghan wouldn't allow us to go through to Kabul. They said that they would furnish their own escorts from the frontier up to the capital. So we had to sort of stay there and wait till the convoy went through and then return back to Peshawar. I think the actual Khyber Pass is about 20 or 22 miles long, all told, before you got to the frontier. And anyway, coming back, the I saw the OC and he told me to carry on and take the armoured cars back. But when I got about halfway down the pass, one of the motorcycle motorcyclists who was with us came up and asked me to go back to see this Lieutenant Crouch and report back to him in a few hundred yards behind. So I went back and he said, "Here you are, Corporal, you can take this back down to Peshawar on it. This is this old Ford T car." And as he sat in the driver's seat, he lifted up the steering column. I said, "It is a bit dodgy, but still, you'll be able to make it all right." So this, I wasn't very keen on this, so I said, "I'm sorry, sir, but I can't drive a Ford T Ford. I can only drive an ordinary Rolls-Royce or one of the other cars." Anyway, he went off and threatened me with all sorts of dire consequences, but eventually I wouldn't budge, and I said, "No, I couldn't do it." Because it was highly dangerous, no doubt about it, because going down those passes, your speed got very fast if you weren't careful, and if you had no control of the steering wheel, you were in dire trouble. Anyway, he said, "Right, report back to me when you get back." So I did, and when we got back, he threatened me with all sorts of things. Stood up and bashed on the table, and anyway, I stood my ground, and nothing else happened about it. But after we'd done these escorts, I think this now was the end of 1923 and beginning up to 1924. And I was sent with another party at the beginning of 1924, just before the hill season started. And instead of going up the hills this time, the unit went to a place called Banu over the Attock Bridge at the River Indus. And we stayed there for some time and done a bit of escort duty and contact with the various passes along the frontier. And it was here that I learnt to play hockey. I remember the sergeant major said to me one day, "You're in the team to play hockey. We're playing the Royal Signals," who were stationed in the vicinity of this camp. And we turned out, but it's quite interesting. And as I was pretty fit, I rather enjoyed it. But another thing happened while I was at Banu. I happened to be detailed as a guard commander one day, and we used to do a guard only during night hours, the 12 hours of night. And I was in charge of the guard there, and about 12 o'clock, the sentry outside yelled out, "Turn out the guard," which was the usual cry when the old officer or somebody like that came round. And when I turned out on the front of the guard room, the sergeant major was there, and he had his stick with him, and then swaying about and shouting. And he said, I'm an acting orderly officer, and I want the guard turned out. Where are they? And he rambled off, and I could tell he was, well, he's drunk. So I told the guard not to turn out, not to assemble, and I warned the sergeant major that I said you're incapable of taking charge. Would you return to your quarters? And he started ramping off at me. So I ordered two men of the guard to take hold of him and put him in the guard room, which we did. After a bit of a struggle, because the soldiers were rather reluctant to take hold of their own sergeant major, but eventually we got him inside, and I sent one of the men over to the company quartermaster sergeant's quarters. He was the next senior warrant officer in charge, and he came across and he said, "All right, Corporal, leave it to me." And he took the sergeant major with him, half carried him, and back to his bunk. And I was very glad of that, because I didn't fancy putting a charge against my own sergeant major. Which brings me to another point, is that whilst I was at Peshawar, I used to have what was called a staff parade, and that was nearly every morning, and that was the parade of all the headquarters staff who weren't normally doing duties like ordinary sextons were, and we had to have a half an hour's drill on a square. Well, usually the sergeant major, there was no sergeant major at that time I'm talking about, apart from the one that when I was telling you about Banu, at there was a staff sergeant mechanist who was in charge of the workshops, and there was several of our NCOs and sergeants in their quarter staff, and these all had to parade, and I used to parade with them. And although the senior was used to the staff sergeant to march us off onto the square, he'd halt them and call me out, and I had the job of drilling the whole lot, because I was the only one who knew all the infantry drill and all the words of command and they could work with. So they all voted me to be the instructor. And it's rather queer, really, if anybody come along and seen a lance corporal drilling all the senior ranks. It's, anyway, it was quite enjoyable, and I used to like that sort of thing, because I was very good at that, instructing people. And anyway, we got to where we get to, Banu and Attock Bridge. So from there, we went to there was one incident where we went to on a horseback ride with my section commander and a lance corporal Stewart, who was one of the chaps who was with me in the section, and we took an armoured car and went out to a certain point and picked up a troop of cavalry. They were Indian cavalry, and there was a white officer, an English officer in charge, a captain, and we met these. The idea was to sort of unofficial visit to the Afghan frontier across the river. And we were allotted each one of these. Me and Lance Corporal Stewart and the officer were given a charger, a mount horse. And although I'd ridden once or twice very precariously before when I was in the First World War, I'd never really learnt to ride, but anyway, they put me on one of these horses. It was an officer's charger, apparently. And although we only had shorts and drill shirts on in those days, it was sufficient for a job other than riding a horseback. But anyway, we rode these horses a gentle trot or a walk across the drive over a bed, up the slope the other side, quite a distance, and we eventually arrived at the Afghan post, and there this officer, the cavalry officer we were with, went up the slope and met an officer from the Afghan army, and they invited us up into a sort of a shelter overlooking the river, which was the frontier post. And inside this covered shelter was long tables, and on the tables was little tiny dishes of all sorts of nuts and sweets and raisins and all that sort of thing. And one of the servants there brought down some, what I learned afterwards was called Russian coffee, and it was hot coffee, and in there was no milk, but you were handed a dish with large pieces of sugar, and these were, you put these in the hot coffee, and also sliced lemon, and this was picked out with a stick from a plate of sliced lemon. You dropped it in the coffee, and it it was quite a refreshing drink after the dry ride we'd had. Anyway, we spent an hour or so there, and we mounted again and went back the way we'd come to join our armoured car. But I think this ride was about 12 miles all told, but the time we got about halfway, I was really scared once or twice, because these horses were trained to a word of command, so that if the Avildar, that was the Indian sergeant, was with us, if he said trot, the horses trotted, and if he said gallop, they galloped. And when he went up slopes, he'd give the order gallop, and these horses would break into a gallop. It was rather shaking for me. Anyway, we eventually arrived back all in one piece, and got back to camp that next morning. My backside was as sore as anything, and I liked this for weeks afterwards, riding these charges back. Anyway, we got to 1924. After that, we went to, or after we left Bennu, we went to a place called Dardoni and Miram Shah, which is a frontier post. And this was at the time of the when the Waziers rebelled, and there was quite a bit of action going on around us. And this post was right out near the middle of where this action was, and we had our headquarters was based there, and we had two armoured car sections, one at Landikota and one at Landikana, which were visited. And this camp was rather interesting because it was unlike the one at Peshawar with all the stone anti-earthquake buildings. It was made of mutty buildings, very similar to the ones when I was in Iraq at Baghdad. And the cantonment, the walls were all about 4 foot high, and they were built of just dried mud and wattle, with the openings here and there so that one could poke a rifle over and defend the camp. Whilst I was here, we had a number of attachments to us from other units, because during the war there was several units of Irish and Scottish units who had mutinied, and they were, this was not really known at the time, but these were then condemned to be demoted, demobilised, and their personnel was the ones that weren't subjected to court-martial or something like that were sent to other units. Well, we had some of the Irish men from the Connaught Rangers, which was a unit which were actually in open rebellion of the British during the 1916 upheaval in Ireland. And these were seconded to the tank corps. Well, these people were more or less segregated by the OC into one hut, and there was nearly all Scots or Irish, mostly Irish. And in our duties as NCOs, the sergeants used to have to go round and make sure lights were out of at night and wake them up and get them up in reveille and all that. And these people were always reluctant to obey any orders, and in some cases were in open rebellion. I went round several times with the orderly sergeant, and he got in the doorway and said, "Stand your beds," so that he could check, see everybody was in. And sometimes these people just simply snarled at him and took no notice. And anyway, eventually the sergeant told me to take down names, and I had to take the names of these people after several times of asking. And some of these we eventually put under arrest in the guard room. And I was with the sergeant, was the chief witness in two or three court martials. And these people were all given long sentences for disobeying orders and all sorts of things against King's regulations. And that brought me to the point where I realised that one of the things that a good NCO's got to do is to learn the manual of military law, which is the law governing the conduct of soldiers during peacetime and wartime. This I did. Anyway, we eventually got back to the shore, and actually before this time, I think it was the end of 1923, a royal warrant was issued and an army order stating that the then tank corps was to become royal. And we were given the privilege of the first British unit to wear blackberries. And these blackberries were pulled over one side, very similar to the French Alpine units were. And we were, and on the right hand side was a silver badge of the Royal Tank Corps. And during tropical places, where you wore shorts, you wore black hose tops. They were a sort of a short stocking with no feet on it, rolled over the top of your socks and pulled down over the top of your putties after you put them on. So you had a black beret and black hose tops. This was the dress that was for the Royal Tank Corps. Anyway, after I'd been to Dardoni, we went back to the shore again. And then on the following year, we'd done the usual things in the army in those days. And we got towards end of 1924, I realised that the soldier in those days had so little to do that some activity was necessary to fill in the number of hours that were spent doing sort of nothing, and it wasn't good for one's morale, or everybody was more or less fed up and said, "Roll on, let's get back to Blighty." But I I thought it would be a good idea to get better educated. And as I was an education sergeant posted to our unit, I saw him one day, and he used to take classes for third class and second class education that I'd already passed a long while ago. And I said, "I'd like to go in for the first class." And so he and I together formed a class of six or eight NCOs we were, all of us. There's one chap from the orderly room at Lance Corporal, and there was another chap from Royal Signals who were close by us, and there was two of our workshop people, corporals, and one or two others. Anyway, we used to, every night or two or three times a week, we'd assemble in one of the buildings of the camp allotted to us for our classroom, and the education sergeant got hold of some maps and all sorts of paraphernalia that we required for a normal education class, and we used to study there and write essays and do sort of homework, as it's called with schoolboys now, and he checked it and correct and advise us as to where we'd gone wrong, and eventually we sat for an exam, a first class exam, and anyway, the result of this was, as it was held every year, you didn't get the result for some time afterwards, but, and it was while I was at a place called Parish and R, that was on towards the spring of 1925. Again, instead of going up the hills, the unit was sent to this place on the Currum River, it was. And this was rather a unique place, really, because the actual unit there was a mixed unit, a sort of self-contained army on its own. And it was officered by British officers, but it was native personnel who formed the units. There was cavalry, artillery and infantry, all formed like sort of levies. And they they were housed in a fort which was very similar to the one, the buildings that we'd been in before, built of mutty, but it was shaped just like an old English castle was, the old Norman type of castle, with turreted walls and towers and a drawbridge over a moat. And or the area in the vicinity of the fort, up to about 800 yards, was cleared of bush or anything like that. And from most angles, looking, if you looked from the fort outwards, you could see large stones which had been whitewashed. And each one of these stones was placed 100 yards away from the edge of the fort, so that the inmates of the fort could range their rifles or guns at the right range to get anybody who was trying to get into the fort. And whilst I was there, the OC of the fort asked if we'd like to go out. They had a stunt going against one of the Wazir tribes in the area.